Okay. Hey, this is Buke from Nine Circles on Gaming. You ask yourself, gaming? I thought this is a heavy metal website. Well, it is up until this point. I am joined by my favorite video game insider, video game editor, writer, podcast host, anyone in the video game world, and more so fans. He's a metalhead, Alex Navarro of Giant Bomb. Alex, how's everything going today?
It's going great, or at least it was until you set me up like that. Now I feel like I'm just going to disappoint everyone because that is a lot to live up to.
Yeah, Alex, for people who are listening and they're like, okay, so the last interview I did was with Troy from Creeping Death, and I've interviewed Randy from Lamb of God. I've interviewed all these artists over the years, and people are like, okay, why is Buke interviewing Alex from Giant Bomb? And I'll give people a little quick background here. For those of you who aren't familiar with Giant Bomb, it's, I personally would say, the best video game website around, by far the best video game related podcasts around. You have the Bombcast, and Alex is one of the co-hosts on the Giant Beastcast, which comes out weekly as well. A couple years ago, the Giant Bomb guys do wonderful video content. I noticed during your guys' famous E3 contents, I'm like, huh, Alex is wearing a Mastodon shirt. Okay, maybe he dips a toe in a little bit. And then the next day, I was like, okay, now he's wearing a Sleep shirt. So I'm like, okay, Alex really knows what he's doing here. And then as I started to really dive deeper into your, you know, tweets and stuff like that, I was like, okay, Alex is a drummer, and Alex really is a metalhead at that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's it's interesting. Like, metal is something that has kind of been in my life on and off for most of the years I've been interested in music, but I've kind of dipped in and out of the fandom at various points in my life. And it's really actually been in, like, I'd say the last 4 or 5 years that I've started, like, getting way, way more into it, like, kind of diving deeper, like, actually looking for bands, not just, like, kind of digging up the, you know, new records from bands I knew when I was way younger, like, kind of trying to get more. I'm not necessarily involved in the scene, but at the very least, like, trying to plumb the depths a little harder than I had been and finding a lot of stuff that just, like, I would not have found had I just kind of remained kind of a surface level fan.
So you saying the old you for years ago, like, I loved how you posted, and I'll share these links in the show notes for everybody to find. But, like, Alex here, his year-end list, he compiled a bunch of albums you like from last year. So the old you would not have probably listened to the Blood and Cantation album or the Cattle Decapitation album.
Probably not. Yeah, I would say that, like, those are I knew who Cattle Decapitation was. I had friends who were very deep into the metal scene that were huge fans of them. But, like, I had just never quite gotten around to taking the plunge on them. So, But in the last few years, like, I've started, like, trying to just check out the catalogs of those bands that my friends have been, you know, ardently recommending to me for years, and really kind of finding corners of the scene that, like, I just never knew existed and realized, like, oh, this is extremely my shit.
Exactly. Now, for those people, you know, who are just listening to you or hearing you for the first time, you are a drummer. You have on the side, you have joined the band None Above All. It looks like you guys are a hardcore band out of New York. Drumming, first off, how long have you been drumming?
I on and off, I would say, well, I started playing when I was about 12 years old, and I'm 38 now. There have been little lulls in my musical interests over the years, but for the most part, I've remained playing drums pretty consistently. I before I joined this band, I had not been in a band for about 7 or 8 years. It was been a while, and I was kind of thinking, like, hey, I probably should try and take one last run at this and see if, like, I can do something that I find enjoyable before I either stop playing or just resign myself to, you know, wedding band gigs to just kind of, you know, as a side venture.
Yep.
But yeah, like, I grew up in a very punk scene. Like, I started getting into music around 12 or 13, like, more heavily. And the scene that I grew up in was very like crust punk, like DIY kind of local scene in Northern California. And there was like a very light metal scene there, but it was very small compared to the number of like local, you know, punk bands, post-punk bands, like just noise rock, like that kind of stuff. And there was also a big ska scene kind of coming up around that. Like it was the mid 90s. So like the ska punk kind of crossover thing was happening a lot at that point. So that was kind of what I grew up in. And so like metal was always kind of like off to the side a little bit. Like I was always interested in it, but like there weren't a lot of local bands that were like, you know, kind of coming up in that scene. So like I kind of wasn't really what I had the most exposure to. It was really later in life when I started meeting people outside of like my own local scene. I started making friends with people who were just like diehard metal fans that I kind of started to explore it a little bit more.
Okay. Now being maybe to my own fault, I'm 37, you know, you're just a year older than me. What was the first album you bought? Mine was Green Day Dookie. And I say that because after I bought my first CD, I really kind of dabbled in music a little bit, never playing an instrument. And I was like a late bloomer in the whole music scene. Like I really didn't get into metal until like 99, 2000 when Pantera, oddly enough, they released their last album, which a lot of people say is probably their worst album. But that to me was like, wow, what is this? And it's opened a world for me that's now been, you know, almost three decades worth of an obsession for me. Like Sunday night, I just saw my favorite band, Opeth, for like the 40th time.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think like, so it's funny you mentioned Green Day. Green Day is actually one of the first shows. I was probably like 13 or 14. It was one of the last shows they played in my hometown right before Dookie took off. Okay. I think Longview was just starting to hit like 120 minutes and stuff like that. So it was like they had recorded the record. They hadn't really gotten big at that point. So it was like their last headlining show at one of the local venues that I went to before they broke huge. But that wasn't the first album I bought. I'm trying to remember what it was. The first one I remember off the top of my head, and this wasn't even one that I bought, but this was someone gave me a tape of this. And I remember this was like how I kind of started getting deeper into punk stuff, was that a friend of mine who I went to junior high with gave me a taped recording of DOA's Loggerheads album, which was like not even like their first record or anything. It was like I think it was like their 1990 album. And I just remember being like, oh, this is really good. And that kind of got me into exploring more of that stuff down the road. There were like some local bands. I think the actual first like CD I ever bought was this local ska band called The Conspiracy, who never really got that big outside of California, but they were like local legends. Like they were beloved by everyone in my hometown. Like their shows always like did huge numbers in Petaluma where I grew up. You know, they were able to tour a fair amount during the kind of that 90s ska boom, but they just never really broke too far big out of that. But everybody that I knew just loved them. And I remember that was like the very first, like I asked my parents for a CD player for Christmas so I could actually play the CD that I had bought at their show when they first put it out.
That is awesome. That was awesome. Now, you know, with us, you know, again, around the same age, we know, you know, we're dip into it a little bit later, but you know, we've seen how the video game world has almost pretty much, you know, totally transitioned to digital, mm-hmm. you know, at least on the PC side. Do you remember the first time you experienced Napster or LimeWire? Do you think it would even get to the point where, you know, you and I could mention any band to another and out of our fingertips we could have millions upon millions of albums on Spotify or mm-hmm. iTunes? I remember over my friend's house, we were downloading Napster, like Metallica promo tracks that would have like beep tracks in it. Like at the time, you didn't realize what you were experiencing.
Yeah. So interestingly, like what I remember about like the whole like music piracy boom and like MP3s and all that stuff kind of becoming more popular is that I actually got in on that like before that stuff was more widely available. Like I had very tech savvy friends who were like definitely into the idea of, oh, we can get music for free. they were like ripping stuff on their own, and they were like, we would have like private FTP servers where we would just kind of send stuff back and forth to each other.
Oh, wow.
So this is like way before, like there was an actual app that people could kind of use en masse to send that stuff around. And then Napster came along and similar services. And I have vivid memories of the one I remember particularly is that, I was a huge Deftones fan growing up, and I still am.
It's funny you mention it, Alex. That's the first album I ever burned a copy of. I burned White Pony onto a CDR. That was the first album. I remember that personally.
I think, if I'm remembering this correctly, I think there was a leaked version of that album that got out a little bit before it came out. And I don't know that it had all the songs or anything. In fact, I think a lot of it was like mislabeled intentionally. But I remember getting a few of the songs from that record before it came out over either Napster or LimeWire, or whatever the hell it was at that point. But the other thing I remember is that when I was just kind of searching around some of the services, that's how I started finding like some of their like B-sides and bootleg stuff, like some of the covers that they eventually put out in a collection, I want to say like 10 years ago or something. But at that point, it was like finding weird pockets of gold you just didn't even know existed. You're like, oh man, they covered this Sade song. Like they covered, you know, this Duran Duran track. I had no idea. And that wasn't stuff that you could like find readily available, you know, in any like music store back when there were music stores. So I remember that being like a focus of mine when I was kind of like trying to dig into some of that stuff, was like trying to find like all the weird rare tracks that I could for the bands that I liked the most.
That is awesome. Now you with drumming here and your band None Above All, hitting the road here for three dates in Florida coming up.
Yes.
I know you have done, you know, charity marathon streams and stuff like that, but how is your body up and ready for hitting the road, playing hardcore shows again? Well,
let's see how it goes. I will say, like, so we played, I think like six shows together at this point, but there has been a considerable amount of time between those shows, up to this point. I'll say my body definitely doesn't recover the way it used to. There's definitely a little bit of like, oh yeah, no, I got to ice that shoulder. Oh yeah, no, I need to take those anti-inflammatories because this is swelling up, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I'm not totally broken down yet. I'm actually kind of surprised how well I have held up considering how little exercise I've had in the time since, you know, I was last in the band. But I don't know, like the energy of these shows has been really good so far. Like the New York hardcore scene is something that I'd always read about, I'd always heard about. It has this kind of like legendary reputation of like, you know, being this hotbed of like really good aggressive music. It has kind of sustained itself for multiple decades. You know, new generations come in and, you know, it's not a huge scene, but like the people who are in it are very dedicated. They're very into it. And like, we haven't played a show that didn't have a decent number of people at it so far. And they're always enthusiastic. They're always into it. And that energy, I think, really sustains me through a lot of these shows. It keeps me going. It makes me want to, like, push past, you know, whatever discomfort I'm feeling in the moment and just be like, fuck it. I'm just going to if I'm bleeding by the end of this set, I'm fine with it.
Exactly. You know, I have heard famous stories like Hatebreed when they were coming up, or any other hardcore band who's done the craziest shows, and they're like, oh yeah, that was a church show, or that was in a fire hall, or that was in a fan's basement. I always wanted to take part in a hardcore show, but I never got to go to one. It's like I always kick myself. I'm a huge Gwar fan now, but for years I passed, oh yeah, Gwar would come around, I'll go see Gwar next time. Well, the first time I saw them, they blew me away, and I wish I would have gone to those small Gwar shows.
Yeah, I saw them. I saw Gwar actually like three or four times because they actually would come through my hometown back in the day. And like the venue I used to hang out at was also sort of like a de facto like teen center. Like it was a place where like the local skate youth would go and hang out. There were like skate ramps everywhere. There was graffiti all over the walls. It was an old movie theater slash opera house that had been kind of retrofitted for shows. It's still there today. It's called the Phoenix Theater. And I remember Tom, who is the kindly old man that runs the place, who is a sort of a beloved local figure. Like every time Gwar would get booked, he would just kind of like there was a degree of resignation in his voice every time, because inevitably he was the one who would have to clean up after them, after the shows. Yeah. But like, he loved the spectacle of it so much. And he, you know, he very much enjoyed like having them there, because they, you know, they brought in great crowds and they were fun shows, that he was just kind of like cool with it. But yeah, I do remember the cleanup after those shows being a real, a real to do.
It almost kind of, it puts a Gallagher show. That's an old reference there, but it puts a Gallagher show to shame.
If there were more slaves and space worms in a Gallagher show, yes, definitely.
So I have to ask, you know, you being in the New York City area, have you caught a show at the famous, and we have a couple of our staff members and listeners in the New York City area, have you gone to St. Vitus and caught a show there yet?
Yeah, I've been to St. Vitus a few times. I haven't been in probably the last couple of years, but I've gone to a few different shows there over the years. It's a really good venue. I like that place a lot.
Yeah, I've heard it's just real cool. Like, it's real small. The band has to walk through through the crowd from the bars to get up to the stage. And really, really cool.
Here at the scene that it is an intimate place. It's got a really good bar. Really good vibes at that place. Like, I've always enjoyed going there for shows. I just don't get out to shows as often as I would like to these days, but mm-hmm. if I could, I would probably be going there a lot more.
I got to ask you, Alex, how did you land? Most of the artists I interview are, you know, the lead singer or the vocalist for the group, because they are the ones who do a lot of the talking for most of the group. So it's nice to talk to, and then, you know, bass players are kind of there in the shadows and nobody really acknowledges them. I got to ask you, how did you land on drums? How did you say, hey, I'm going to start playing drums?
That's interesting. My dad grew up. So when I grew up, my dad was a guitar player and has been a guitar player for like, I'm going to say 50 years at this point. And he tried to teach me. Like, early on, I was interested. I wanted to try and learn. And I just had zero aptitude for it. Like, no, like, I tried to understand it. I tried to learn the basics. And I just had no real understanding of it, no mind for it, which was frustrating, because I really liked music and I wanted to play music. But, like, I just realized that was not going to be the instrument for me. It just did not work. So years later, I went to elementary school with Taro Hart, who was the son of Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart. And wow. Taro and I weren't friends or anything. Like, he was a grade below me, and like, we kind of knew each other, but we weren't like that friendly. But his dad would come around the school every now and again. He was a really nice guy. And at some point, I forget exactly what the sequence of event was, but Mickey was doing this thing called Planet Drum, which was very much this like world music flavored show where he would get like percussion from all different corners of the earth. And he would just like put them all on stage and try out a bunch of different, you know, basically put on a whole show just around rhythm and drumming. And somehow I got invited to one of those shows and I decided to go. And while the music itself was not necessarily like what my interests were, like, seeing that kind of breadth of different, you know, percussion styles and different things kind of made me realize that, like, hey, maybe that's the direction I could try going in. Like, maybe there's something there. Maybe there's something to that. Like, my brain maybe can kind of latch onto that more. So I asked to start taking lessons. I started taking lessons for about a year. And I realized, like, yeah, no, this is going to stick. This is what I like doing. This feels good. I feel like I understand this. Like, I do not have a natural, innate sense of rhythm, but like, it felt like something I could develop, and I did eventually develop over time.
Yeah, and this was something that, when you weren't in a band, was this something? Did you still have a kit at the house? Did you have a little pad? Like, how did you keep your chops up throughout the years when you weren't in a band?
So the first year I was just taking lessons. I didn't have a drum set or anything. That was just like pure going to practice once a week. My parents got me a kit for a very cheap, like, Sunlight drum set, which was this very like bargain basement brand, the sort of in the vein of like sub Mapex level, you know, kind of low key drums, but, you know, great for a beginner. And yeah. After I got that, I remember I had my kit set up in my bedroom. And after a while, my parents were extremely not cool with that anymore. So I remember they went and they had the garage soundproofed so that I could just go put the drums out there and practice out there.
Oh, nice.
And then, you know, as the years went on and as I started living in apartments in major cities, it became a little more difficult to have a drum set with me at all times. So these days, I have basically what is amounts to an e-kit, but it also is what I use to play the Rock Band video game stuff. And that has become my practice kit. Like, it's pretty quiet. Okay. It's an easy way to, it's built out pretty much the same way I use or I have set up my own kit. So it's a good practice setup. And whenever I have shows, these days I'm mostly playing on house kits with like my own snare and cymbals. If I ever get to a point where we're actually touring in a van or something, I guess I will bust the rest of the drums out of storage. But right now, that's kind of what I'm sticking to.
Yeah, I've always wondered because I have the, you know, I've said it before on numerous podcasts. I have the writing skills of a caveman. I'm a klutz, so trying to play instruments, I was an athlete. I had, you know, physical ability, but never was able to play an instrument or anything. So trying to talk about musical theory or instruments, a lot of the times it goes over my head. But just as a fan, I've always wondered with, especially with drums, do the e-kits transfer over to playing on the full drum kit?
Yeah, they do. It's not... Like, the difference for me is just the amount of energy I'm having to pour into making the sounds. Like, on an e-kit, you don't have to hit that hard. You don't have to really, like, push too hard on the drums to get kind of, you know, to hear the sounds and to make it come out. On a real kit, there's a lot more, for me at least, there's a lot more, like, energy spent on playing a set than there is just playing on the e-kit. It's, so you mentioned earlier, like, the charity streams that I do. Mm-hmm. So for as part of a yearly charity drive, we do a thing where we will do these video game marathon streams for children's hospitals. The charity is called Extra Life. And so I do these marathon drumming things where I play through like a whole bunch of songs in the Rock Band video game, which is, you know, played on the pro level, like is not one to one, but very close to the actual straight up drum charts for those songs. And so I'm able to play that stuff for like between 12 to 24 hours without completely burning out my body. Whereas on a regular kit, you know, I play like a 3 or 4 hour practice with my band. And by the end of it, like my arms are just noodles. Like my legs are noodles. Like I need to go lay down for a little bit. You know, it's a lot more energy spent and there's a lot more that goes into just sort of pushing yourself into the music in that stuff than just like playing on a, you know, on a practice pad kit.
I got you. Are you able to do double bass drum, double kick and everything? Is there anything that you're working towards or trying to improve as a drummer?
Like I have very basic double kick skills. Okay. I've never had like really intricate, like good double kick ability. That is something I'm trying to relearn as we speak. It's one of those skills where like if you don't have the setup in front of you at all times, like that left leg will start to atrophy a little bit. Yeah. So I'm trying to get back to where I used to be with it.
Yeah, you know, Alex, I'm so glad you just mentioned that, you know, with the atrophy itself. Like, you know, as a drummer, interesting question here that just came to mind. Like, you know, in the black metal world, when they roll into those blast beats on the does that just... When you get to that level, when you're just hammering out a blast beat on the kick drums, does it, in a sense, the faster you go, does it kind of get easy when you, other than changing up the time? Because to me, when I hear them do these hour and a half long sets with these blistering bass beats, it just seems like that would be exhausting.
It seems that way to me, too, if I'm completely honest. Like, I, okay. I have that exact same reaction to that kind of stuff. The thing I've come to understand, and this is something that I'm still developing, you know, after all these years playing drums, is just, like, it's more about control than it is anything else. Like, the speed is important, and you have to develop that. But it is also just about making sure that that speed is working at a controlled rate and making sure that, like, you are putting in a consistent amount of energy into every hit. So that you aren't like, you know, accidentally, you know, banging the snare like on the threes, you know, like too hard. Yep. Or whatever, like so that your leg isn't just like burning out like 5 seconds into what you're doing. Like it really is about developing a consistent level of control and a consistent amount of like, I mean, I guess just like cardio, you know, just like knowing that like you're kind of locked into a very specific thing. Rather than just sort of like, you know, waving your arms and your legs and just like kind of going full bore, like, you know, animal style. into that stuff. Like that's the thing I'm trying to develop, is that same level of control, because it is something I've always wanted to try and do, but I'm also a very heavy-handed drummer. Like I am not an intricate player. I am not a jazz player. I am not a guy who's going to like, you know, throw a lot of like ghost notes and like really intricate, like, you know, ride cymbal rhythms into shit. It's like, no, I just sort of bang my drums as hard as I can for as long as I can. That's just always been the kind of player that I am.
Yeah.
And I have nothing but respect for people who have that level of control, and I would love to develop it. I just don't have it naturally.
So you have, what's that guy from the Muppets? You're like Animal behind the drum.
Exactly. Yes. I am very Animal. I am like a 38-year-old Animal.
So when, you know, I mentioned I was at, you know, I saw my favorite band Opeth again the other night. When you watch a live show, are you able to, just like with, you know, I'll use the analogy with like video games. Mm-hmm. Are you able to, you know, since you professionally review video games and talk about games, or, you know, as a drummer, are you able to listen as a fan, or does your drummer ear, in a sense, ruin you being able to enjoy live music, that when you hear the drummer or the rest of the band getting out of time rhythm, do you pick up on that right away? And just like a gnat, like a fly in your ear, it bothers you the whole way through.
No, you know what it is? Like, yes, that drummer ear definitely hits me. Like, I definitely notice stuff, you know, especially like I do watch drummers a lot when I'm watching bands. Even if it isn't like a drummer that's doing anything super crazy, mm-hmm. like it's just like kind of my natural attention span, why it kind of drifts to that. But the other thing is that like I fuck up all the time. Like I am not, you know, a perfect drummer. I am not, I as much as I am, you know, maybe aspiring toward greater levels of intricacy and perfection, like I'm definitely not. So it's not about like I definitely used to be, I would say, probably more judgy, but these days I kind of just look at it's like, okay, well, they got off time there, whatever.
It was good,
you know. It's just like being able to notice it doesn't ruin the music for me. It just makes me realize, oh yeah, no, these guys are humans like anyone else. They're musicians, you know, like they're not going to hit every single thing perfectly every time unless they are the most trained, most dedicated people. Everybody messes up every now and again. Who cares? They're not ruining the show. I mean, unless they're just an awful band, which I'd like to think I don't go to too many shows where like really awful bands play. That's I try to avoid that.
Well, what was the last show you were at? Do you have any upcoming shows?
So the last show we just played at this place called The Nest in Brooklyn. Are you saying shows that I played or shows?
No, yeah, both. Either. Yeah, both.
We just played at this place called The Nest in Brooklyn. We just, you know, it was a free show. We had some of our friend bands playing Examine, Fragmented, Total Waste, who are like local hardcore groups. So we have these shows coming up in Florida. We're playing in Orlando and Vero and Melbourne this weekend, which are kind of all Central Florida areas. And I'm really looking forward to those. We're playing with this band called the FA, who are local Florida favorites. I've never met them, but they are friends with the other guys in my band. So I'm looking forward to meeting them. As far as shows that I went to, the last show I actually went to was it was High on Fire and Power Trip when they were on tour together. And that was a real good show. Those guys are real, like both those bands are incredible.
Safe to imagine Matt was shirtless up on stage riffing.
Extraordinarily shirtless. And honestly, like the most energized I've seen him on stage in a while. You could tell that like he was really itching to get back on the road because he was into it.
Yeah. Just, you know, I saw them years ago and I don't think I realized what I was seeing at the time, because I remember he came on stage and I was still new into my metal voyage, and I didn't realize who I was seeing or what was about to happen to me, but it still left a impact on me to this day.
Yeah, for sure. They are incredible. And Power Trip is a band that like the last couple of years, like they have been in constant rotation for me. Like
amazing.
My girlfriend is actually the one who found them and was like, oh, you need to check these guys out. And I have been listening to them pretty much nonstop since that 2017 record came out.
Oh, dude, that Power Trip, I saw them, was it on a Mastodon show or something? Blew me away. And I just dove into them. Eating up their whole catalog. And I mentioned Gatecreeper. I mentioned Creeping Death earlier. There's a whole band's coming out, like this Texas hardcore, like punk scene is really pretty cool.
Yeah, it's neat. And, you know, there aren't necessarily like a ton of bands just doing like that straight up thrash style, you know, these days, or at least not ones that I've been, you know, like current new bands that are doing it. I'm sure there's plenty that are out there. I'm just saying, like, from my personal experience level, I have not encountered a lot of bands that are just doing that straight up thrash style and doing it that well. So it's really rad to see that.
No, I see really looking here at your like year of list last year, like the Gate Creeper album. I love mm-hmm. that album was a home run. I think that was my number three so album good. Of the year. Oh,
yeah.
Amazing album. Now, the Russian Circles album, Blood Year. Amazing. Could you see yourself maybe like you have this hardcore project? What if a metal band that played more traditional death metal or even the instrumental metal was looking for a drummer? Could you ever see yourself sliding into a metal band?
Definitely. I mean, when I was looking, you know, for other projects to join up with, like I tried out for like a noise metal band. You know, I talked to a couple of other bands that were like kind of doing some like doom sludge type stuff. I don't think I could do death metal. I don't think I have the speed for it. I don't think I have like the endurance for it, but like something in more like the post sludge doom style where it's like, it's not as much about speed as it is about just kind of getting that kind of slow, nasty rhythm going. I feel like that's something I could definitely fit into. Like, I love that style of music. Like that Moth Gatherer album that I put on my list last year was absolutely my favorite. Like, I love that kind of like droning kind of atmospheric metal sound. I love that shit.
You know how I knew you were a real metalhead, aside from all these other gems that are on your list, but this Numenorian, I knew I pronounced it wrong. Numan.
I'm sure I probably pronounced it wrong too. Yeah.
The Door album. Oh, amazing.
Yeah. Amazing. There's as much as I feel like modern rock and, you know, the kind of just the general like mainstream radio rock scene has just completely died a horrible gasping death, I feel like metal in the last decade has really stepped it up in a major way. Like
big time.
The more I dig into it, the more I find stuff from like the early teens and like, you know, stuff from the last 5 years. Like, it just feels like, you know, as much as mainstream music has kind of gone away from rock, like metal has just been thriving. And it's a really awesome thing to realize that, like, oh, there's all this incredible music over here. No one's ever going to hear it if they don't go looking for it. Yep. But that's fine because the people who go looking for it are going to love it.
Now, I was going to mention again, I'm talking to Alex Navarro from Giant Bomb. He's also the drummer from None Above All. And they're actually on Bandcamp at noneaboveall.bandcamp.com.
Yes.
Alex, do you guys have any plans to maybe after this tour record new music? I see this last album, Climate of Hostility, looks like that was done back in 2017. Anything maybe featuring you coming up?
Yeah, so we actually did also just put out an EP with our friends Enziguri, who are from the Bronx. It's a 9-song EP, or 7-song EP, 4 songs from us, 3 from them. So that just came out at the end of last year. And we do have some new material. We have some stuff that we're working on. We do not have a set record date or anything, but I think the target is to get something out before the end of the year.
Okay.
So we'll probably have another full length coming sometime in the relatively near future.
And Alex, you mentioned it about, you know, how it's a great time for metal and stuff like that. You know, what I think is making it, like a bunch of the guys and gals who I do this podcast with or this website with, we've all met through social media, more so sharing Bandcamp and stuff. And I think like the iteration of Bandcamp, especially in the metal world where a lot of people, not knocking any other genres, you know, the country or the rapper, whatever other genres there are out there, but it's the metal world. At least from the numbers I've seen, the fans seem to really support the artists. And Bandcamp has allowed fans to directly support the artists by buying from them for vinyl, from shirts. And it seems like Bandcamp has helped metal explode. It's still underground, don't get me wrong, but it's allowed it to explode and allow us to find new music every single day.
Yeah, and I think more to the point, it's allowed bands that aren't the already known quantities to really get themselves out there and get themselves in front of people, which has always been the barrier in music, right? Like it's, you know, as soon as you get signed to a label, you're front and center, you know, you're getting the attention. but you know, the bands that are kind of on the fringes that are maybe not, you know, getting the label interest, maybe not getting, you know, noticed the same way, are struggling. And I think that, you know, as much as complain about the modern in it there for a lot of very good reasons, one of the things it has done well is that it has allowed artists to get their stuff in front of people in much more meaningful ways that actually benefit them, other than just having their stuff pirated. You know, like it's great for bands to have these resources and to have these places where they can just sort of centralize all their work and direct people toward that isn't just like, yeah, I don't know, check us out on the iTunes store. You know, like there's that you have at least a measure of control about where that stuff goes. And I think that's really important.
But also, you know, I've mentioned it before on other shows and, you know, talking with friends and stuff. It's like the same problem we run into. You know, this new pod's going to be focused on gaming also, but I wanted to bring you into the fold. Is that like with Steam, I think we're starting to unfortunately see that there is just so much on Bandcamp that if, let's say, you come into the office one day or, you know, you get home, hey, let me check Bandcamp today. If you maybe take a week off or something, you could miss 20, 30 new releases that you may all be good just because there's so much hitting there on a daily basis.
Totally. And that is a real problem in video games, and it is definitely a real problem as these platforms get bigger and bigger. And I think that's inevitably where word of mouth and people – you know, people who are entrenched in these scenes getting out there and talking about the stuff that, you know, matters most to them and is, you know, most exciting to them is important, because inevitably curation is where all this stuff, you know, where it comes together. Like, there have to be people who are out there like saying, yes, no, this is the band you should be checking out. This is the thing, you know, just waiting for the platforms themselves to do that curation work is never going to work. Like, for the same reason Steam will never limit the number of games they have on their platform, because there's literally no business reason for them to do so. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Bandcamp will probably never really try and solve that problem on their own. It's really about the people who are in the scene and the people who are, you know, who have any kind of platform to get out there and to promote the stuff that I think that matters most to them.
Well, Alex, like, you know, with you mentioning Steam with us with Bandcamp, do you ever see... Of course, you know the video game industry better than I ever will. Do you ever see there ever becoming one unifying system above everything else?
I mean, I think the closest we're ever going to get is Steam. I think Steam is the platform that has just sort of by default become the major player, just because of how much money Valve has to throw at this thing and how, you know, like how... There was a time when Steam was first launched that a lot of people didn't think it was going to be much of anything.
Yeah.
But then it became, you know, it essentially became the dominant marketplace for digital game sales. And you're seeing, I think in response to that in recent years, you're seeing other things start to crop up to try and counteract that a little bit. Like Epic has their own game store now, which they are going hard after exclusives. They're looking for, you know, they're trying to get stuff on their platform for exclusive amounts of time. And they're kind of trying to, you know, cut into Steam's, you know, their business model and trying to cut into their sales and create some real competition. I think more interesting to me, just, you know, as someone who plays a lot of video games, is something like Itch, which is a strictly independent marketplace. It is a place where a small number of, you know, like basically like smaller creators can host their stuff and potentially get it. You know, I don't know all the business stuff behind it, but what I know is that like people who use Itch really like it. And it's a way for these smaller games that probably will get lost in the shuffle on a Steam or an Epic store, to at least get some notoriety. It's a place for that stuff to live. I find that platform, like, I don't think that's going to be the thing that takes down Steam or anything, but those are the kinds of platforms I would love to see more of, more places that are willing to kind of like work outside the, hey, we need to make sure that every big shooter gets on this platform kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you, Alex. One of the reasons why I'm so excited to talk to you is because, you know, at 38 again, you've been in the video game industry for how many years now?
I was doing some freelance stuff when I was a teenager, but like my first real job in video games was when I was 21.
Okay. Now with that, I've always been telling myself, you know, as I listen to you, and I would listen to you, you guys, you know, every night when I was working, I thank you for, you know, countless hours saving me when I was working for some rough nights.
But, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
But you know, if I always would tell myself, if I had a chance to talk to you or Vinny or Jeff, I honestly want to know, with decades in the industry, what excites you about games now? Because the one thing that I love, and I really direct fans to listen to your show again, the Beastcast, listen to the Bombcast, check out all the video content on giantbomb.com, follow you on Twitter. That's at, it's Alex_Navarro, NAVARRO. What I appreciate you guys is how honest, brutally honest you guys are. And I'm not saying just being assholes and pricks about your honesty, but you guys give constructive criticisms. Like, you and I could go on and on about your honest thoughts on like Death Stranding last year. Mm-hmm. I direct anybody to listen to that. But what excites you about video games now in 2020, after you've been covering it for decades?
That's a hard one to answer, because video games are in a very strange place right now. We're on the cusp of new consoles, which is always like a reset for the industry. But this one feels less like one than ever before, because we're now in a place where these hardware upgrades are becoming much more incremental. Making sure that previous platforms games appear or are playable on the new platform is something that companies seem a little more invested in than they used to be. So what we used to look for as far as like what is the big new thing in video games, which was oftentimes the hardware, doesn't really feel like as big of a thing anymore. And likewise, the number of risks that major companies can take these days is fairly low. Like, games have kind of, I don't want to say this universally, because there are definitely companies that are working outside this box, but like, there is a homogeny to the way designed these days that I think for me has kind of gotten a little stale. Like, everything has to have, you know, a specific kind of leveling system. Everything has to have these specific kinds of loot drops. Like, everything has to be open world in some way. There's a, you know, if not always online, then there has to be some sort of asynchronous online component to these games. Like, everybody's kind of designing, I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of companies are designing within this very specific wheelhouse, trying to hit these benchmarks that for some reason people have decided this is the way games have to be designed, because some games were successful doing these specific things. And it's not that I don't think those games can be good. Like, some of those games are still very enjoyable to me, but it's not what excites me. And if I'm thinking about what excites me, I don't know. It's like, I want to say it's just what's coming out of the independent scene, but the independent scene on its own has also become this very diverse and very, like, you can't just say I love indie games, because what an indie game is has so many different definitions.
You got that right.
And so for me, I think it's just, it's still, it's when something comes along that surprises me, something that I've never heard of, something that, you know, isn't from a studio that I have some existing history with, something that I'm just seeing people like, oh, this came out of nowhere and this is awesome, you need to try that. Like, that still happens multiple times to me a year. Just because, you know, so many games are being made that inevitably there will be these, you know, gems that just sort of like rise up out of nowhere. And, you know, there's been a lot of those games for me in recent years, a lot of stuff that I just didn't necessarily think that I would like, that I ended up like falling in love with. You know, I never was big into like the visual novel genre, but like this game Neo Cab that came out last year, which is it's a cyberpunk game about being a rideshare driver in a sort of San Francisco-like tech dystopia. And it's got this really incredible writing to it, like just really excellent character work, you know, that really like feels very lived in despite the kind of like fantastical futuristic setting. And stuff like that, that just like I wouldn't necessarily be on my radar, but then kind of bowls me over. Like, those moments are the ones that make me go, yes, no, I still love this medium. I still love what people are doing here.
Like, Alex, I'm so glad you just mentioned that. Like, your write up, I remember I was, you know, if you take a second, ever stop and think where people are listening to your show and what they're doing, you could think of 1,000 different possibilities. But I was in my tree stand deer hunting, listening mm-hmm. to your guys' year-end podcast when I heard you championing Ape Out. And yeah. Like the drum work alone in that, the music alone in that, I would stand on the tallest mountain and cheer for that game and try and champion it for everybody to play it. And like when I heard your excitement for that, that's why I wanted to ask this question. What excites you? Because, you know, as somebody who's, you know, of course, followed you for years now, I can tell when you guys are excited. And Ape Out was one of those moments that I could tell you were genuinely excited for your year end game Judgment. You were excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always going to gravitate towards stuff that is definitely, like, if not a music game, then is something that uses music in an interesting way. Like, that's something that I always love in video games. Like, one of my favorite rhythm games the last few years was this game called Thumper, it's from one of the designers, is one of the guys in Lightning Bolt. It is this really fast, but also just, like, haunting and discordant kind of rhythm game where you are a space scarab, like basically hurtling toward oblivion. And then these, you know, you're just trying to like navigate these incredibly tight spaces to this music that just sounds like the soundtrack to your road to hell. And in the case of Ape Out, they use the whole game is just jazz drumming. Like it is the soundtrack is, you know, very much like that incredible, like, fucking Buddy Rich style, just like crazy jazz drumming. And but it's all AI. Like there is an AI that is built into the game by this guy named Matt Bach, who I used to work with at Harmonix. And it's not just making clangs and bangs to the rhythm of your action. Like there is an underlying beat that and building alongside the action in a way that feels very musical. It doesn't just feel like noise. And that's a really wild thing to pull off, you know, in a small video game, like getting an AI to like actually create something that sounds rhythmic and sounds musical, that isn't just, you know, just a bunch of samples playing over stuff, is really crazy. And, you know, I mean, the game itself is super fun. It has a really great kind of, you know, Saul Bass flavored art style, but like, the music and the drumming is really what like caught me in that thing. And I was really impressed with it.
Yeah, it was definitely a gem for me that, you know, if it wasn't for you guys talking about, I wouldn't have found it. So I thank you again for what you do there. A couple more questions and I'll let you go. Again, you know, you mentioned new consoles and stuff coming out. You've been around. I've grown up with, you know, again, just a year younger than you. You know, I've been around for every console launch since the NES. Do you still get excited this time of year or every couple of years when this happens?
I mean, yes. I think there's something ingrained in me that is just sort of like, new console year equals excitement. Like it's an equation in my brain that just will never quite dissipate. But you know, I think, like I said before, like the excitement level is maybe not what it used to be in the sense that, you know, we got the Xbox One X and the PS4 Pro just a few years ago. And while they are incremental upgrades to the existing hardware, they're still pretty powerful systems and they're still doing really impressive stuff with this hardware. And like, you know, PC games these days, like look really incredible. And it's not that I don't think the technology that they're planning on putting into these new systems is going to impress people. Like, I think, you know, ray tracing and other tech stuff that they're talking about with this stuff, a lot of the buzzwords they're using around these consoles, like that stuff is going to create really impressive looking games. But I think I've kind of hit this threshold in my life where like just looking better isn't really necessarily what I'm looking for. Like there are lots of games that aren't necessarily the most visually impressive things in the world that still bowl me over just because they're creative, they're interesting, they do things with art that isn't necessarily just like rote realism, you know what I mean? And as much as, you know, playing something like, you know, last year's Control on a card that has like ray tracing turned on, yeah, that shit looks good. But the most interesting stuff in that game isn't like the lighting and the realism. It's like the art design in the background, you know, it's like the crazy, you know, quarry level. It's like all the background stuff. And I wish
it's a little
like,
puppet hope, videos.
Yeah, totally. Like what I hope more than anything else is that eventually we will start not necessarily get away from, because there are always going to be games that try and be hyper realistic. You know, military shooters, things like that are never going to get too buck wild with their art design because inevitably they are trying to recreate something in particular. But what I'd really love to see more of is, you know, devs that want to do some really abstract, weird shit with this tech, like find stuff that looks different, that doesn't just look like, hey, we made this person's skin look more like actual skin. Like, you know, when I look at the games that I think that are more compelling to me these days, it's people that are willing to just create a style that is of their own, that feels very much like their own, you know, their own artistic sensibility that isn't just recreating realism. And I think that's what I hope more people will do with this console tech, like find ways to use that technology, bend it in ways that isn't just, hey, those guns look real good. You know what I mean?
Alex, since the industry, you know, continues to change and YouTubers and Twitch streamers and everybody can have a platform, you know, for better or worse, for anything that they want to try and champion now. How have you guys at Giant Bomb, I'm not, you know, talk like a business thing, mm-hmm. but how do you guys compete? And I'm talking to, I think, as a father of a 5-year-old little girl who, you know, will grow up and, you know, she'll start getting influence from many different places. How do you guys start to, I guess, stay relative? So like the up and coming gamers don't look at you. Oh, Alex, he doesn't know what he's talking about now. He's an old grandpa now. Have you ever thought about that?
Oh, every day of my life. Honestly, it's something I do here. I mean, there are definitely lots of people who are super into games now, be they streamers or just fans, you know, players who have no real basis for knowing who I am or who anyone at Giant Bomb is other than, well, they're those guys at Giant Bomb, you know? And yeah. Like, as much as it is gratifying to have people come and say like, oh, yeah, I used to read you on GameSpot back in the day, you know, I know who you are. I realize that's probably not the majority of people who are playing video games right now. And I'm, you know, I'm at peace with that. I realize that the space we occupy in video games is not a common one. You know, there aren't a lot of people from the generation I started in who are still covering video games. Like lots of the people who were writing about video games for websites, for magazines, have either moved into other corners of the industry, you know, in development, in PR, et cetera, or they've gotten out of games entirely because it just wasn't sustainable. We've been extraordinarily lucky to be as sustainable as we have been over the years, you know? And I think part of it is we have been willing to change to a degree. Like we haven't looked at the way the industry has changed, the audience has changed, and tried to push against that. Like, the reality is it's going to change and things change at an ever more accelerated rate as the years go on. And if you aren't willing to adapt to that in some way or another, you're just going to get left behind. And, you know, there's going to be limits to how much we can change because inevitably, you know, we are products of where we came up from. We have our experiences. We have our history in this industry. And like, we're not going to just, you know, throw our format and our way of doing things by the wayside because, well, Ninja is really popular, so we should just start doing what he does. But at the same time, you know, I think that we've come to understand that, like, there are certain things that people expect from a website that covers video games that our stuff happens to align with. And so if that's what people want, that's what we're going to do, you know, as long as we're happy with it, as long as we're enjoying ourselves, because that's really kind of the founding principle of Giant Bomb. We're not going to do stuff just for the sake of doing stuff. We're going to do stuff because it means something to us. It's important to us, or we just enjoy it. And I think that the reason we've been so lucky is because we've been lucky to find an audience that also happens to enjoy the same things that we do.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned it. You know, almost kind of like a sentimental moment there. Of course, you know, you've worked in it, but you know, you're in a sense, you're part, like you, Jeff, Brad, Vinny, you guys, you're part of the old guard. Like you've been there, you know, for decades now covering this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, Jeff started doing this stuff and I think he started GameSpot in 1996. Vinny would be the newest of that group because he started at GameSpot back in, I think, 2005 or 2006. I started in 2003, Brad a little bit before that. There aren't very many of those folks left. You know, they've all moved on to other things. Yep. They've, like Greg Kasavin, who was my executive editor at GameSpot when I started there, like he went and founded Supergiant, which is the makers of Bastion, Pyre, Transistor, the upcoming Hades.
Oh, that and, Hades looks amazing.
Dude, Hades is great. I've been playing the early access version of that game.
Awesome. Alex, I'm glad you just touched on that. Is now the right time to buy Hades?
I think if you waited this long, you could probably stand to wait, because I think it's pretty close to content complete, if not entirely. I've just been checking in on it like a couple of times a month, just, you know, playing a little bit, being like, oh, yeah, no, still digging this. It's a really good mix of like that roguelike style of, you know, repeated runs with that really nice drip feed of Supergiant style narrative. And what they've had in the early access version all along has felt very playable. It's always felt like a real game. Like there's enough content there to keep you busy. And the way I think they've been messaging and updating that thing has been great so far. So I would recommend you get into Hades whenever you want. I mean, I'm probably going to start it over again once the 1.0 drops, but that game is still really good.
You know, maybe if there's one thing that, you know, we all kind of have the hill that we will die on. And I hate to say back in my time, it used to be, but I remember, you know, when you and I were growing up, you know, a demo was all that we had. Demo of a PC game or a demo of that was all we had.
Or you got a demo disc in a magazine or something.
Exactly. Early access to me is always just felt like a money grab, where you're just kind of drip fed little content that just seems to pad the pockets of the game developers. And you know, I can understand that they get money, but I don't like, you know, little spoonfuls of games at a time. I like to. Hey, I'll either play a demo or I'll play the finished product.
I think the spirit behind early access is a good idea. I don't think every developer latches onto it the right way. I think that in the case of Supergiant, and there have been some other ones that I play, like the Red Hook, the Darkest Dungeon developers, like that was a really good early access experience for me. Like, I think those roguelike games in particular are served well by that thing because the runs are inevitably fairly short. You know, even when they change a bunch of content, like it doesn't feel like your game has just disappeared.
Yeah,
I think the spirit behind early access is a good one. I think it allows devs that maybe don't necessarily have like a strong financial backing to essentially, you know, to gain capital to help create the vision that they want to. It's something that can be exploited in a bad way. And I do think that there have been early access experiences that haven't been great, but by and large, it's a thing I want to support because I think it does help developers along the way. I think it helps them fine tune their games in a way that they wouldn't necessarily get to otherwise, because a lot of these devs don't necessarily have the money to go out and create like focus groups to play their games the way that like AAA devs do. So I think that there's something to that. Again, it is something that can be exploited badly, but I think the idea behind it is good. There just haven't been a lot of games I wanted to play in early access because I think like you, when I start something, I just want to be able to play through the whole thing. I don't necessarily want to keep checking in on it. It's really, for me, been those more like roguelike experiences where my runs don't feel like they're getting ruined by new content being added or things being changed, that where I've managed to latch onto that stuff.
Alex, I got two more things. Last one. Have you ever thought of, I know, you know, years away, hopefully, from, you know, you live a long, healthy life and everything like that, but have you ever thought about life after video game journalism, anything maybe you thought you may want to do maybe in a second career or anything? Or would you like to kind of maybe have a foothold in gaming as you move forward?
It's hard to say. You know, I love video games and I love the life that I've been able to build within, you know, the industry and within media. Like there was a brief period where I did something else. I went to Harmonix for a couple of years. I worked on their community and PR team on the Rock Band games, on Rock Band 2 and Beatles Rock Band specifically. I don't think I could ever do PR again, honestly, because the only reason I was able to do PR for that company is because I genuinely really loved their games. Like, I think Harmonix, you know, especially at that time, was making stuff that really spoke to me.
I'm so sorry to jump in. I'm glad you mentioned it. Why did the collapse of those games happen? Because they were so fun. What, was it just too much saturation?
Was 100%. It was too much saturation. I'm not blaming Activision specifically for this because I think both companies were maybe a little too willing to engage in that that arms race among, you know, Plastic Instrument games. But I do think that Activision's attitude toward Guitar Hero was definitely much more about saturation than it was about like making good games. Like some of those Guitar Hero games were great.
The Metallica one.
Yeah. Like I think World Tour was a really solid game all around. Like those games, like they made some really great ones, but they also like churned out some stuff that just wasn't great. And unfortunately those were expensive games. They were really expensive. The instruments were expensive. Getting people to buy into that stuff over and over again was difficult over time. Like, I think, to my mind, Harmonix had the right attitude with a lot of this stuff, which was to say that, like, hey, we're going to go out of our way to try and make sure that your DLC carries over from game to game, so you're not out songs, you don't have to, like, rebuy a bunch of stuff. You know, I think they had the right idea. The problem was they got pushed into a position where, like, they had to keep churning out games every year, otherwise they weren't keeping up. And, you know, Harmonix put out some stuff that wasn't super great either. Like, that Green Day Rock Band is not the best. You know, they put out a bunch of track packs that were like basically just an excuse to buy DLC at retail. Like there was stuff there that wasn't great either. I do think some of that saturation just got to a breaking point when you got around to stuff like Beatles, which I think was a really great game. It didn't necessarily hit the way that everyone thought it was going to because people had already bought so many Plastic Instruments and played so many games that it just didn't get all the way there. And, you know, you saw it, they tried to bring it back. Rock Band 4 is still a supported game. They're still putting out DLC for it. There was that Guitar Hero remake, which the makers of DJ Hero put out a few years ago, which was really neat. They tried to redo how guitars played in those games. Yeah, and it's like they tried some stuff in that game that I thought was really cool, you know, like trying to do like a more streaming style music selection. The way they changed the way you play guitar in that game I thought was really interesting. It just didn't take. And I think people just weren't ready to get into another big Plastic Instrument war now. And now like Rock Band is supported by a couple of songs a week, and you know, they're probably not going to make another one of those anytime soon. It's unfortunate, but I think it's just the nature of the bubble that was sort of built up around that thing. They got really successful really fast and it just didn't stick.
Yeah, you know, and Alex, since you have been in this for decades and stuff like this, has this afforded you, like I've, you know, commented a couple of times on, I do respect and love your guys' honesty that you guys have. If you love something or if you don't, again, you're not just throwing out, you know, just curse words and expletives and hate speech without, you know, when you have negative complaints, you guys share them in a, you know, professional criticism. But of course, and not to speak for you, but I'm sure you've built up friendships with numerous developers and producers over the years. Do you kind of sometimes, have you ever caught yourself maybe having to step back and say, hey, you know, I am, you know, still a journalist here, or has this allowed you this? I guess where I'm going with this is, how has being in this for all the decades you've been in it, how's your relationship with the developers kind of been?
I mean, I've definitely made my friends on the development side. I definitely have people that I know and respect a lot and have maintained friendships with who work in development, who work on the business side, who work in PR, et cetera. My attitude has always been, when I am criticizing something, I am not attacking you. It is not about that. It's not, sometimes there are games that like straight up offend me. It doesn't happen that often, but you know, sometimes something like a Blackwater comes along and I'm just like, no, this like, just at a moral level, this is reprehensible. What are you people doing? But the number of times that comes up in video games is fairly low. And you know, when someone I know makes a game that I don't necessarily love, I approach it from the same critical place I approach everything, which is to say that like, I don't think you're bad for making this. I just don't think this hit the right notes. I don't think this, you know, this worked the way you wanted it to. I don't think you got out there the way that you needed to get out there with whatever this was. And that's just, you know, that's criticism. I think the majority of people who I'm still friends with and who I've maintained those friendships with understand that. And it hasn't come up that often. Like every once in a while, I will play something and be like, man, I really wanted to like this, but I couldn't. But I haven't had very many instances where someone has come to me and said like, how dare you? How could you say that about my work? You know, how could you say it? Because I think there is a degree, or I'd like to think there is a degree of mutual respect between the people whose work I'm criticizing and, you know, myself. Like, I think they understand that I'm not coming at this from, you know, a caustic or, you know, unthoughtful place. Like I don't go after or say negative things about games just because, you know, it's something people will latch onto. It's because this is my opinion. I spent the time, I played it, and I just didn't, it didn't resonate with me.
I gotcha. Well, Alex, we have spoke for over an hour here. I'm going to say again for everybody who listens, this is Alex Navarro from GiantBomb.com. He's also the drummer for None Above All. I don't think this was posted beforehand, but hopefully you guys, if you're down in Florida, you will see him possibly this weekend on a couple of dates. Alex, you guys are going to be doing more shows coming up maybe over the spring or summer?
Yeah, we have a bunch of shows lined up in New York and New Jersey in March. I think we have a couple in April as well. And then I think after that, A, I'm going to be starting to go into my getting ready for E3 hole. And then also we're going to start getting the new material ready to hopefully start recording by the time the summer rolls around. So we'll see. But yeah, in the next month or so, if you're in the New York, New Jersey area, I will definitely be posting on my Twitter feed, like which shows we have coming up. So keep an eye out for that.
And your Twitter handle again?
It is Alex_Navarro, N-A-V-A-R-R-O. I am on there, and you can always find Giant Bomb's various Twitter happenings and videos and podcasts on our Twitter feed, which is just at Giant Bomb.
I highly recommend you guys check him out. The best around. Alex, it's been a pleasure talking to you, brother.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, man. I appreciate it. Thanks, my friend.